Okay, so get this. You're a public defender working hard for your client, but what happens when you honestly believe their appeal is a lost cause? Can you just like throw in the towel?
Well, that's the dilemma at the heart of Anders v. California.
Anders v. California.
A Supreme Court case that really shaped how appeals work for people who can't afford their own lawyer.
We're diving into this legal thriller today, and trust me, it's got more twists and turns than you might expect.
You know, it's funny. This case isn't just some dusty legal precedent. It gets to the core of what equal justice actually means in practice.
Exactly. So to set the scene, we need to go back to 1959 and meet Charles Anders. He was convicted in California for marijuana possession and wanted to appeal, which, you know, is his right. But his court-appointed lawyer thought his appeal was a dead end.
And that's where things get really interesting. The lawyer basically wanted to quit, but the Constitution guarantees everyone the right to an attorney, and that right doesn't just disappear because a case looks tough. Anders's situation sparked a huge constitutional question: do poor defendants get the same quality of legal help as someone rich who can hire a dream team?
So that's how this case from California ended up all the way at the Supreme Court.
Right, the stakes were incredibly high.
Yeah.
We're talking about the bedrock principle of equal justice under the law. Can a lawyer simply abandon their client because they think the appeal is weak? And if not, what's the alternative? The court had to come up with a solution.
It's like a legal thriller. You've got individual rights clashing head-on with the practicalities
Yeah.
of the legal system. What did the Supreme Court do? They didn't just say, figure it out yourselves, did they?
Not at all.
Yeah.
They came up with a pretty ingenious solution, the Anders brief. It's named after the case, obviously.
Right.
Justice Clark, who wrote the majority opinion, essentially said, look, we need a system that protects everyone's rights even when the odds are long.
Okay, so what is this Anders brief? You're going to have to break that down for me. And for anyone listening who might not be a legal eagle,
Sure.
why is this thing so important?
Imagine you're the lawyer and you've gone over the case with a fine-tooth comb. You genuinely believe there are no strong grounds for an appeal.
Right.
You can't just abandon your client, though.
Right.
So what do? You file an Anders brief.
So what does that look like in practice?
It's a document where you say, okay, court, full transparency, this appeal is probably a long shot. But T, just in case, here are a few points, even if they seem minor, that might, just might, support an appeal. It's about making sure that even a seemingly hopeless case gets a fair look, at least a second glance.
So it's like a last-ditch effort to find something, anything, that
Yeah.
could potentially help the defendant, even if the lawyer themselves thinks it's a long shot.
You could put it that way. It's a way for the lawyer to fulfill their ethical duty to the client while being candid with the court about the perceived weaknesses of the case.
Right.
The idea is that indigent defendants deserve just as much zealous advocacy as anyone else. Just because someone can't afford a high-priced lawyer doesn't mean their appeals should be tossed out without thorough consideration, right?
Right. That seems like a pretty clever compromise. But I'm guessing not everyone on the Supreme Court was on board with this solution.
You're right. There was a dissenting voice, Justice Stewart. Now, Justice Stewart wasn't arguing against the right to counsel. His concern was more about the practicality of the Anders brief. He thought it would force lawyers to file a mountain of pointless paperwork, even in cases that were truly, absolutely hopeless.
So from his perspective, the Anders brief was just a waste of time and resources for everyone involved, not really helping the defendant in any meaningful way.
Exactly. Justice Stewart felt like it was a bureaucratic hurdle that didn't really address the core issue of ensuring effective legal representation for indigent defendants. It was just paperwork for the sake of paperwork, in his view.
So we've got this clash between making sure everyone gets a fair hearing and making sure the legal system doesn't get bogged down with unnecessary procedures. That's a tough balance to strike, for sure.
Absolutely. And this debate didn't end with the Anders decision. It's still going on today. The Anders brief is standard practice now, but many people question whether it's truly fair to defendants or just an illusion of help.
It makes you wonder, is it possible to create a system that guarantees everyone a fair shot, even when the odds are stacked against them? That's a question that goes far beyond this one case.
You're hitting on something really important there, and that's what we're going to dig into further as we continue our deep dive into Anders v. California. It really makes you think, what does equal justice actually look like in a system where resources are limited and not everyone starts on the same footing?
Yeah, it's a big question for sure. And it brings us to another fascinating aspect of this case, the impact on lawyers themselves. We've talked about how the Anders brief affects defendants, but what about the lawyers who are actually filing these things? It can't be easy to be in a situation where you feel obligated to file an appeal that you believe is doomed to fail.
Oh, you're right. It's a huge ethical dilemma. Imagine you're a public defender, overworked, underpaid, maybe feeling a little burnt out. You have a mountain of cases, and then you're assigned to represent a client on appeal. You go over the case, you do your due diligence, and you come to the conclusion that there's just no chance of winning.
So you're essentially convinced that any appeal would be frivolous.
Yeah.
But you still have to go through the motions.
Exactly. And now you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, you have a professional duty to zealously represent your client, to fight for their rights, to explore every possible legal avenue. But on the other hand, you also have a responsibility to the court, to the legal system as a whole, not to waste everyone's time and resources on appeals that you believe are going nowhere.
So you're torn between your duty to your client and your duty to the system. Talking about a classic ethical dilemma. It's like the lawyer is caught in a legal tug of war.
That's a great way to put it. And that's precisely the kind of tension that the Anders case highlighted. It forced the legal profession to really grapple with these tough questions. How do you balance your ethical obligations to your client with your responsibility to uphold the integrity of the whole legal system?
And to add another layer of complexity, you have to remember that your client might be looking to you as their only hope. They might not have a deep understanding of how the legal system works, and they're trusting you to navigate this complex maze on their behalf.
Right.
They may not see the appeal as a lost cause, even if you do.
Absolutely. It's a heavy burden to carry. And that's why the Anders decision, while it was groundbreaking, didn't magically solve all these ethical challenges. It provided a framework, a procedural mechanism for dealing with these situations. But the core dilemma, the balancing act that lawyers have to perform, that's something that remains a constant in the legal profession, especially when you're dealing with appeals.
So it's not just about checking boxes and following a set of rules. It's about judgment, about carefully weighing competing values and making tough calls in a system that isn't always black and white.
Precisely. It requires a lot of nuance and careful consideration. And that's one of the reasons why Anders v. California is still such a relevant and thought-provoking case, even all these years later. It's not just a historical footnote. It's a living, breathing legal concept that continues to shape how we think about fairness and justice in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, it reminds us that behind all the legal arguments and procedures, we're dealing with real people and real lives, people who are depending on the system to work fairly, even when the deck seems stacked against them.
It's a human story at its core.
We've talked about how Anders affects defendants and lawyers, but what about the courts themselves? How did this decision change the way appeals are handled within the judicial system? Did it make things easier, or did it create a whole new set of challenges?
That's a great question. The Anders decision had a major impact on the way courts, especially appellate courts, handle cases where the appointed lawyer thinks the appeal is without merit. Before Anders, the process was much less structured, much less formal.
So a lawyer could basically just send a letter saying, nope, there's nothing here, and the court might just take their word for it. No further questions asked.
You could say, yeah, it was a much simpler system, but not necessarily a fairer one.
Right.
But the Anders decision forced the courts to take a more active role in these situations. Remember, the Supreme Court's biggest concern was making sure that defendants who couldn't afford their own lawyer still received adequate legal representation even when their lawyer thought the appeal had no chance.
They wanted to make sure that nobody was being denied their right to a proper appeal just because their court-appointed lawyer wasn't willing to fight for them right.
That's the heart of it. And to achieve that, they created this Anders brief procedure, which placed a new set of obligations on the courts. It's not just about the lawyer anymore. Now the court has to get involved too.
Interesting. So how did that work in practice? What did courts have to do differently because of Anders?
Well, first, the court can't just rubber stamp the Anders brief automatically accepting the lawyer's conclusion. They have to independently review the brief look at the case themselves and make their own determination.
So it's not enough for the lawyer to say the appeal has no merit. The court actually has to roll up its sleeves, dig into the case, and make sure nothing is being overlooked. That sounds like a pretty big responsibility, wouldn't you say?
It is, and it adds a new layer of complexity to the process, but it's an important safeguard.
Yeah.
And second, if the court in their review finds any potential issues, any arguments that could be raised on appeal, they can't just ignore them. They're obligated to appoint new counsel to represent the defendant.
So even if the first lawyer thought the appeal was a lost cause, the court can step in and say, wait a minute, there might be something here, and the defendant deserves to have a lawyer who's willing to fight for them.
Yeah.
It's like a second chance for the defendant to get their case heard, even if they're first lawyer wasn't convinced.
Exactly. The Anders decision essentially shifted some of the responsibility for protecting the defendant's rights from the lawyer to the court. It's a kind of checks and balances system,
yeah.
Making sure that nobody slips through the cracks just because their lawyer doesn't see the merit in their case.
It's like adding a safety net to the system, a way to make sure that everyone gets a fair shake.
That's a great way to think about it, but it's important to remember that the Anders procedure, while it was designed to protect defendants' rights, also had implications for how efficiently the courts could operate.
That makes sense. I can imagine that if courts had to appoint new counsel every single time a lawyer filed an Anders brief, things could get bogged down pretty quickly.
You're absolutely right. The courts would be drowning in a sea of appeals, and the whole system would grind to a halt. So the Anders procedure is a compromise. It gives courts a way to scrutinize potentially frivolous appeals without having to appoint new counsel every single time.
Mm-hmm.
But it also makes sure that if there are legitimate grounds for an appeal, the defendant won't be denied their right to a lawyer who believes in their case just because their first lawyer wasn't convinced.
So it's a delicate balance, isn't it? Trying to safeguard individual rights while also making sure that the courts can function efficiently and effectively.
It is, and it's a balance that's constantly evolving. The Anders decision laid the groundwork, but the legal system is always adapting to new challenges and new interpretations of the law. And that brings us to a really important question. What's the state of the Anders brief procedure today? Has it stood the test of time, or are there new challenges and controversies surrounding it?
That's a great point. We've been talking about Anders v. California like it's ancient history, but it's still very much a part of our legal system. And like you said, things change, new issues arise, and the law has to adapt. So what's the latest chapter in this ongoing story?
Well, the first thing to understand is that Anders v. California wasn't the end of the conversation. If anything, it was just the beginning. The Anders decision opened up a whole new chapter in the ongoing debate about how to ensure effective legal representation for indigent defendants.
So even though the Supreme Court set out this framework back in 1967, the debate about how to best put it into practice, how to make it work in the real world, that's still very much alive and well.
Absolutely. And that's what makes this case so compelling, even all these years later. It's not just a dusty old legal precedent. It's a living, breathing concept that continues to shape how we think about fairness and justice in the criminal justice system.
Okay, so we've established that the Anders brief, while designed with good intentions, has its fair share of critics. What are some of the main concerns people have raised, and how have those concerns played out in real-life cases?
Well, one of the biggest criticisms you hear is that the Anders brief process can create this, like, illusion of advocacy.
Okay.
Critics argue it can devolve into a box-checking exercise where lawyers just follow the steps without genuinely engaging with the case or truly advocating for their clients.
So they're technically meeting the requirements of Anders, but maybe not putting their full weight behind it, not really fighting tooth and nail for the defendant's rights. That seems like a serious issue, if true.
It is a serious concern, and there have been actual cases where courts have accepted Anders briefs without doing a thorough independent review, essentially taking the lawyer's word that the appeal was weak, and that completely undermines the whole point of Anders, which is to ensure even less than ideal appeals get a fair hearing.
It's like the system is designed to protect the defendant, but sometimes the gears get jammed up in practice.
That's a good way to put it. It's not always a smooth process. That's why some legal scholars and advocates have called for reforms to the whole Anders brief system. They argue courts need to be way more diligent in reviewing these briefs, not just skimming them and rubber stamping whatever the lawyer says. Some even suggest we need, like, stronger ways to ensure lawyers are providing truly meaningful representation, even when they personally believe the appeal is weak.
So it's not enough to just have a procedure in place. We need to make sure it's actually working the way it was intended, that it's actually protecting those who need it most. It sounds like a constant uphill battle to keep the system running smoothly and fairly.
It is. It requires constant vigilance both from the courts and from the entire legal profession. Another major concern is that the Anders brief puts lawyers in a tricky ethical spot. We touched on this earlier, the struggle between your duty to your client and your duty to the court itself.
Right. It's that legal tug of war we were talking about. Not always an easy situation to navigate.
Exactly. And the Anders brief can make that tension even worse. Picture this. You're the lawyer, and you're convinced your client's appeal has no legs to stand on. But you also know your client may not grasp all the legal intricacies and is probably holding on to hope that an appeal could overturn their conviction. It's a sensitive situation.
So you're trying to be honest with the court, but also manage your client's hopes and expectations, all while upholding your ethical duties. That sounds like a real tightrope walk for a lawyer.
It can be. Some critics of the Anders brief argue that it actually forces lawyers to be less than fully truthful with their clients. They say that to comply with the Anders procedure, a lawyer might have to downplay how weak the case is or even present arguments they don't personally believe in.
That creates a situation where the lawyer might feel they're not being completely straight with their client, which could really damage that crucial attorney-client trust.
That's the fear. It makes you wonder if Anders, while trying to be helpful, actually ends up harming the very people it's supposed to protect. Some legal experts argue it'd be better to have a system where lawyers can be upfront with their clients about the weaknesses of the case, even if it means advising them to not appeal at all. Honesty from the start, even if it's tough news to deliver.
So instead of jumping through the hoops of an Anders brief, the lawyer could have a frank, open conversation with the client about their options and what a realistic outcome might look like.
Exactly. Proponents of this approach argue it would create a more efficient and ethical system overall, one that respects both the client's ability to make informed choices and the integrity of the entire legal process.
So it seems like the debate about Anders and its implications is far from settled. But stepping back from the specifics, what's the big picture legacy of Anders v. California? What lessons can we take from this case over 50 years after it was decided?
I think one of the biggest takeaways from Anders is how vital effective legal representation is, especially for those who can't afford to hire their own lawyer. This case was a wake-up call reminding us that the right to an attorney isn't just about having someone physically present in court. It's about having an advocate who is truly fighting for your rights, exploring every option, even when things look bleak.
So it's not just about checking the box and saying, yep, the defendant has a lawyer.
Yeah.
It's about the quality of that representation, the level of dedication and skill they bring to the table.
Exactly. And Anders, I think, helped bring that distinction to light both within the legal world and for the public at large. It made people confront the uncomfortable reality that simply appointing any lawyer isn't enough. We have to make sure those lawyers are well-trained, have the resources they need, and are genuinely motivated to provide the best possible defense regardless of their client's financial situation.
It's about making the system genuinely fair,
yeah,
ensuring everyone has a real chance, not just the appearance of one.
That's the goal, isn't it? But Anders also serves as a cautionary tale about relying too heavily on bureaucratic fixes for complex social problems. The Anders brief, though created with the best intentions, has shown flaws in practice. It can lead to lawyers going through the motions, clients being left in the dark, and courts not providing enough oversight.
So it's a reminder that we can't just create a system and then walk away. We have to constantly check in, make sure it's doing what it's supposed to, and adjust things as needed. We can't forget about the people at the heart of these legal processes.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Yeah. Anders v. California was a landmark case, no doubt about it. But it also continues to challenge us to make us grapple with fundamental questions about fairness, equality, and what it truly means to have effective legal counsel.
This deep dive into Anders has been eye-opening, to say the least. It's a case that might seem dry and technical on the surface, but once you start digging, you realize it touches on some of the most crucial pillars of our justice system. And the questions it raises are just as urgent now as they were back in 1967.
It's a reminder that justice isn't some static, fixed thing. It's an ongoing process, a constant effort to make sure the scales are balanced and everyone has a chance to be heard.
It's a call to action for all of us, whether we work within the legal system or not.
Mm-hmm.
Justice requires us to stay informed, to ask hard questions, and to push for a system that lives up to its ideals. That's something worth striving for, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Well, that wraps up our deep dive into Anders v. California. We hope you found it informative and thought-provoking. As always, we encourage you to keep exploring these issues and to join the conversation about how to create a more just and equitable legal system for everyone. Thanks for listening.